Okay, we're ready to get started. Thanks for coming, everyone. I appreciate everyone's time and people coming out to the session. My name's John McIntyre. I am with the Azure Document DB product team at Microsoft. Azure Document DB is a new service from Windows Azure. It's a fully managed NoSQL document store. So as you might guess from the title of the session, today I'm going to do a fairly broad pass on Document DB. With the intention of, first I'll give you an introduction. For those of you who aren't familiar with DocumentDB, I'll walk you through some of the capabilities of the service, some of the attributes of the service, and how you can think about leveraging some of those capabilities. Then I'll walk you through getting started. I'll try to keep this as interactive as possible. I have a lot of demos. Those demos are both in the Azure Management Portal as well as in Visual Studio, so I think you'll get a good feeling for both the management experience as well as the development experience associated with the service. So hopefully there's a little something for everyone. We'll get started. We'll create a new database account. We'll talk about how easy it is to do that with this fully managed service. We'll start storing some data into DocumentDB and talk about how DocumentDB stores that data. Then I'll introduce some of the query aspects of DocumentDB and how DocDB serves queries over this schema-free data. And then we'll finish up with the transactional support and the JavaScript integration into the database engine and taking advantage of some of that for transactional processing. So before we get started, I'd love to do just a show of hands. How many people, well, actually before that, I'll also say, in the spirit of being interactive, if you have questions along the way, feel free to raise your hand. I won't feel like I'm being interrupted. It's sometimes helpful to answer questions within context, and we can have a fairly interactive dialogue on DocumentDB today. So first, how many people think within the next 6 months that they will or are already evaluating NoSQL databases? Wow, great. You've come to the right place then. And how many people are using NoSQL databases today? Okay, so about half the people that are looking at those NoSQL databases. And how many people have looked at, read about, tried DocumentDB? Okay, great. So a few people there and some fertile ground, I guess, in terms of getting you up to speed with DocumentDB is all about. And then last question, I promise this is the last time I'll ask you to raise your hands. How many people went to David Chappell's session yesterday on NoSQL? Oh, great. So it looks like a lot of people went to that session. For those that didn't go to that session, I highly encourage you to watch that session online. David did a really great job in terms of framing NoSQL and the various options that Azure provides for NoSQL data stores. He talked about operational stores as well as analytic stores, and he also draws some comparisons of how to think about in the relational world. And I think fundamentally, as we're seeing more and more of these databases appear, for you as people who use this technology, there's more and more choice and more about finding the right tool for the right job. So what I'd love to do today is help you understand this tool, and hopefully you can find some jobs at which it will perform very well. So one of the things that David also talked about yesterday was this notion of trade-offs. As you make these choices with respect to where you're going to store your data, there are a set of trade-offs that you're making as you look at what data store is appropriate for what data you're going to store and the workload on top of that data. And this is, Microsoft's not exempt from this in terms of how we think about which databases we're going to use. And as we build these large scale both services and applications, we face the same choices, we face the same trade-offs. So very early from the development stage, we've been engaged with MSN at Microsoft. And MSN came to us as the data platform group at Microsoft with some fairly daunting sets of requirements. MSN is composed of a set of vertical experiences. There's roughly 10 vertical experiences. They range from food, weather, finance, and these types of experiences that surface through the MSN web experience, but are also available as applications on mobile devices, ranging from Windows devices to iOS devices to Android devices. So the permutations in terms of the number of application combinations, vertical combinations, was starting to really slow down the MSN team in terms of the team that was responsible for providing the user data store for all of these applications. And these applications were constantly revising and constantly iterating. And so the things that were clearly very important for the MSN team is running a service like this at scale. That scale is always important, knowing that any service that they bet on is going to be able to run at scale, is available globally, and can scale to the needs of what their demands of their application are. The other piece is performance. I think we all know that users have high expectations on performance. They want predictable performance through their experiences. So they needed a data store and a data platform that would predictably deliver great performance from a read and write perspective. And then the last piece, but almost the most important piece in terms of continuing the innovation of verticals in MSN was allowing these vertical teams to operate independently, but storing all of that data in a common store. So they wanted to move to a schema-free system. They knew they had to move to a schema-free system to have this autonomy in these applications. But all of these vertical teams did not want to give up a lot of the capabilities they had to query over that data. So we worked very closely with the MSN team to get them on board of DocumentDB, and we were really pleased last month, was today October, yeah. Last month in September, the MSN site went live with DocumentDB as its data store for the user data store for these vertical applications in their production environment. So it was really great to see these one of the Microsoft's premier services and at-scale services leverage DocumentDB for its scenarios. At roughly the same time or slightly before, we introduced DocumentDB as a public preview on Azure. DocumentDB is available today as a preview service. It's available in the Azure preview portal. You can create database accounts today. So some of the unique things or how we thought about DocumentDB as we were both building it and thinking about these scenarios, much like MSN scenarios, as well as other services, the first sets of decisions we made were around data format. When we talk about document stores, you know, David said this yesterday, when you think of a document store, don't think of a PDF or a Word document, but a document store as a JSON document store. And JSON, really just a storage engine to store JSON fragments, and a storage engine that deeply, deeply understands that JSON format. And we felt by making this commitment to the JSON format, then we can do some very unique things. So as data is stored and transferred within DocumentDB, and how you interact with the system is all native JSON, the database engine itself understands JSON, stores documents as JSON, and is highly optimized for JSON. I'll talk about some of the things that we're able to do by virtue of that deep commitment to JSON. And really, I think as you see or interact with web services today, JSON is fairly ubiquitous. You can produce or consume it on any platform. It's a very nice, tight serialization format. And so increasingly what you see is also people also using JSON as a way to serialize objects. The second piece is adhering to the schema-free sensibilities of a NoSQL database. And often, when you go schema-free, it's at odds with the queryability of the database. And you give up some of that queryability to go schema-free. Or you might decide, okay, well, I have to specify secondary indexes, or I have to build pre-computed views on top of that schema-free data, which then starts to loosen that promise of schema-free, and you start to bind to specific schema elements in the document. So what we strive to achieve with DocumentDB is to allow the store to be queryable and schema-free at the same time. So all properties within a JSON document are automatically indexed. I'll talk a little more about the query and index and how we achieve that a little later in the talk. But what this allows you to do is store arbitrary data within the database and then query over any of these arbitrary properties. And part of the reason why we're able to do this is that deep commitment to JSON and really understanding that info set. The next piece is transactional processing. And at the risk of introducing religious debates on whether stored procedures in databases are good or not or evil, I think what we feel is there are very many use cases where transactional processing in the form of stored procedures and triggers are very useful from a database perspective and can alleviate a lot of complexity in application tiers if you're not having to deal with that at the application level. So DocumentDB supports transaction processing in the form of stored procedures and triggers. The procedural language that we use to support this is JavaScript. And so people might ask, well, you chose SQL as your query language and as that familiar query language. Why did you choose JavaScript as the procedural language? And really, it's because of that nice, tight relationship between JSON and JavaScript and the ability to materialize JSON documents as JavaScript variables and the low impedance from a procedural programming perspective of operating over those JSON documents. And JavaScript was a very natural choice from a transaction processing perspective or in a language that we would support in the database engine. The next piece is tunable. Many NoSQL stores today support both strong and eventual consistency. And if you've built experiences on eventual consistency, and there's a tendency to use eventual consistency because you want all those great performance benefits that come from trading off data consistency. But with those great performance characteristics, often you give up the predictable experiences that you may want to deliver to your users. And so it's very challenging to deliver predictable application experiences on eventually consistent data. You may get data out of order. You may miss certain writes, or writes may disappear on you. And so this can be really challenging. And so what we've tried to do with DocumentDB is really to provide some definition in that gray area between strong consistency and eventual consistency, and really define some click stops in between so that you can make smart choices about the data consistency within the database and what makes most sense for your application. So DocumentDB supports four consistency levels, eventual consistency, strong consistency. The third consistency level is bounded staleness. Bounded staleness is really interesting for timeline-oriented applications where you may have multiple users or multiple writers on data, and you want to read that, and you want to make sure that you get timeline consistency on that data, and you're willing to trade off some staleness of the data. So with bounded staleness, you say, I'm willing to tolerate a certain staleness interval of my data, but please never give me anything more stale than this interval. And that's expressed as a bounded staleness consistency level. The fourth consistency level is actually the default for DocumentDB is something called session consistency. Session consistency is really useful for user-centric applications. Session consistency says that I get read-my-write semantics. So as a writer, I'm always guaranteed to read back the write that I just did. And I've traded off global consistency. So I may not see all the writes of all the different writers, but I always get a consistent view of my data. So we see a lot of use cases around these user-centric applications where it's important for the user to get a singular view of their data, but they're willing to trade off the consistency. You know, the canonical scenario on this might be like if you use Facebook, apparently half the internet population uses Facebook, but if you use Facebook and you write to your post, you write to your wall, you want to know that you see it, but everyone else eventually sees it, so you get eventual consistency characteristics on the data at a global level, but a session consistency at a user-centric level. So we provide you the ability to tune your consistency. So you can set your consistency level, and this is done at a database account level. And then you can override that consistency programmatically. So if you have places in your application where you say, I really want better performance, I want the best performance that I could get out of the system, on a given read, you can decide to loosen the consistency level and achieve that better performance. The other piece is DocumentDB is designed and optimized to run on solid-state hardware. It runs on all SSD-based systems, and so it provides very consistent and predictable performance relative to latency. And the last piece is scalable and fully managed. This is where I would do the cloud-first pitch. And as much as it sounds like marketing and we did this cloud-first database, there's actually really something there, especially as you look at building a service from the ground up that is designed for multi-tenancy, designed to be resource-governed, designed for predictable performance. And it's a different approach. You take different approaches. And I think the way that this gets exposed to customers, and you tend to see this manifested, is the units by which you consume the service. So what this allows us to do is take very granular slices of resources and give them to you as a tenant as you need to use them. And so you can scale your database account as you need to scale, whereas you may see in other systems that are just running on machines underneath, and effectively you're being sold VMs underneath the database, you see these very large step functions in pricing. We're like, oh, okay, I want my database to get bigger. Okay, well, we're going to sell you some more machines. And so what we've tried to do is to provide a really granular knob in terms of as you need to scale, we'll give you those dedicated resources in the system that you need. We'll ensure that there's isolation in those resources and that your performance is guaranteed. But we're not going to sell you these big chunks. You don't have to kind of go big chunk by big chunk. You can incrementally scale as you need to scale. Okay, so that's kind of the pitch, the introduction, the sets of attributes and key characteristics of DocumentDB that I think are worth internalizing as you make those trade-offs from an application perspective and as you're looking for an operational store for your data. Next, I want to hit the basics. Before we get into using DocDB, before I start to show you some of the management interface, before we start to write some code against DocumentDB, it's always helpful to understand just the basics associated with the service. And the first thing is useful to internalize and understand is the resource model. The resource model is how we structure data within DocumentDB. And at the very top of the resource model is something called an account. If you're using Azure today, you may be using a storage account. It's a fine analogy to think of a database account much like a storage account. A database account is where you provision capacity against. So as you purchase DocumentDB, you purchase in these reserved units of database storage and throughput. Those are assigned and entitled at the account level. Underneath each account, you can create databases. And you can create as many databases as you need to create. Databases have users and permissions. It is not a authorization scheme. It's not an authentication scheme. It is for authorization purposes. So we support granular permissioning. You can create a user and a permission and effectively ACL down to the document level. So if you wanted to lock down particular documents and have role-based permissioning, you can do that through the use of users and permissions. Databases are also the container for collections. This is where you would have the natural instinct to say, well, a collection is just like a table. Resist that urge. Although it may look similar, you may want to think of it similar, collection is not a table. David Chappell talked about collections as shards. I think that's a fine articulation of the characteristics of a collection. Sometimes we talk about them as partitions, is another way to think about it, but they are a container for JSON documents. You store your JSON documents within a collection. Collections are also where you register stored procedures, triggers, and user-defined functions. And the reason for this is because a collection is also the transaction boundary. So you can execute a transaction within the boundary of a collection. A collection is also a query boundary. So as you issue queries against the system, you do that against collections, and you retrieve documents from collections. So your data goes into these documents on the upper right-hand side of that diagram. DocumentDB also supports attachments. So if you have binary data, blob data, that really doesn't fit in a database, you know you're not going to query over it, it's not efficient to query over, and it's not efficient to store it, you can store it as an attachment. We then take that attachment, we put it into blob storage. The benefit you get by storing your attachment with us is that you'll have lifecycle management. So if any of the parents of that attachment disappear, then we'll clean up those attachments. And then you also get permissioning associated with that. If you choose not to store your, if you have associated blob data or file data, media, photos, videos, please don't store those in DocumentDB. You can store them in attachments, or you can store them as a reference attachment link or media link within a document. DocDB supports that as well. So effectively, just give DocumentDB a pointer, and that'll be stored as well. The pointer will be stored, and you can refer back to where that data is actually stored. So that's the first thing around the basics, which is the resource model. Then there's the interaction model. How do I interact with DocDB? DocDB, all of these resources are exposed REST over HTTP. So there's a RESTful interface over this. All of the standard HTTP verbs are supported over that interface. So you can interact with the system from any REST HTTP stack that you want. You can write lots of apps that use the service that way. And so that's one model for interacting with the system. We also provide a set of libraries. If you don't want to go write those REST calls and construct those REST calls, we have a set of libraries around .NET, Java, Python, and JavaScript. In terms of queryability, queries over SQL. I'll walk through the SQL grammar and how we express queries as a SQL grammar, how hierarchy is expressed in that SQL grammar, and then server-side programming is JavaScript. User-defined functions, stored procedures, and triggers are all written as JavaScript. So now we get to move into demos, and I'll actually show you the service and play with the service. But before I do that, maybe I'll just pause in case there are any questions to this point. Captivated audience.
When you say the TCP connectivity,
yeah,
that's obviously a lower level.
Yeah, so the question was, hey, on that slide, I'll paraphrase. Hey, on that slide, you talk about TCP connectivity. Is that at a lower level, or how should I think about that? So there are two protocol heads that the service exposes. One is an HTTP protocol head. The other is a TCP-based protocol head. I'll talk through this a little bit in the demo, but we support a notion of both direct and gateway connectivity. So gateway connectivity, think of these as there's a logical to physical address mapping that happens because, you know, replicas are dying and being rebuilt and moved around and rebalanced, and so you don't want to rely on a physical address. Now, what direct connectivity allows you to do is directly communicate to those physical replicas, but then you have the burden of managing that address, that lookup, effectively the logical to physical. The both of those. That is typically used on TCP when you do TCP connectivity. HTTP typically goes through the gateway, although you can do direct connectivity over HTTP. So in terms of when and where to use TCP, I would advise, and I'll have some tips and tricks, but where you can use TCP, where you can use direct connectivity, it'll give you the best performance. Gateway connectivity is useful in cases where if you have like a client application or a JavaScript page that's talking to the service and you can't make a TCP connection from that, then you want to use HTTP, and maybe it's not stateful, so you can't do address caching and things like that, and so you hop through the gateway. But where you can, you want to use direct and TCP connectivity. And the .NET client, I'll walk through the .NET client and how you configure that and talk about some of the connection protocol options. Yeah, question?
Is the stored procedures and triggers and so on, do they only operate on data within that same collection,
or do you kind of like have a collection that you put all your code in and then your documents go in other collections that you operate on?
So, well, the question was recorded, so hopefully everyone caught that. Stored procedures do execute in the boundary of a collection. So the scope of a stored procedure, and I'll walk through an example, is operating on all the documents within that collection. We do not support cross-collection transactions or stored procedures. Okay. So let's show some demos. Let me just log into my machine. Okay, I'm going to start in the Azure Preview Portal. I don't know how many people have used this today, but this is the new Preview Portal. You'll start to see some services show up exclusively in the Preview Portal. Search and DocDB are some of the services that are now available through this Preview Portal. Over time, you'll see all services show up in the Preview Portal. So this will be the primary interface moving forward. If you haven't seen it, it is a fairly drastic change, but I'm not going to get into the nuances of the Preview Portal. For creating a new database account, you open up what's called the gallery. Within the Marketplace gallery, you can navigate to Data and Analytics. And one of the data services listed under Data and Analytics is DocumentDB. So that'll pull up the details page, and you'll get a create button. So if I click on create, it'll take me through the steps to create a, let me just do this, there we go, to create a database account. You'll see the first thing that I'm asked for is an ID. The ID is used for that DNS entry. So if I say TechEd demo, so I can enter the ID. The ID will be used, you see, as prepended to documents.azure.com. The pricing tier for preview, there is a single pricing tier. It is the standard pricing tier. And pricing is based on the number of capacity units that you consume. Capacity units, as I mentioned, are a unit of storage and throughput. So this is the guaranteed performance and SSD-based storage that you have available with your database account. When you're creating your account, you can choose as few as one capacity unit, and then as you need to, you can scale those capacity units both up and down over time. So as the changes, as your application needs change in terms of scale, you can move that up and down in the slider. The capacity units are really only constrained by how fast we can move servers into data centers. There's no practical limit in terms of the size of a database account. For the preview, we are limiting account sizes, and largely this is so we don't have anyone hoarding capacity, but if you need larger accounts than what's allowed at preview, give us a call, submit a request through customer service, and we'd be happy to help you out. Okay, the only other thing I need to select here is location. For preview, DocDB is available in West Europe, North Europe, and West US. We'll be bringing other regions online in the coming months, so those will be available soon. Okay, so I could click create here, and that'll go and create my database account, but as with any good cooking demo, I'll pull the prepared turkey out of the oven. Okay, so if I go to my home screen, I have two database accounts here. These are accounts that I've already created. And here you can see some of those aspects of being a fully managed service and integrating with the Azure platform start to show up. The first is you'll see monitoring data for that database account. I can actually configure that monitoring data. So if I want to add request types and filter based on request types, I can see how my account is performing. I can also create alerts. So if we go and we create an alert on that account, I may want to say, hey, I want to get email every time this database account gets throttled. Let's see. So we'll pick our metric. We'll pick throttled requests. I'll I'll click that drop down again. So I could filter based on any of these response types, classes of errors, 200s as successes, 400 as user class errors. I can filter on internal server errors and also throttled requests. So I'm going to do this one on throttled requests. And where there are more than 5 throttled requests in the last 5 minutes, oops, I neglected to click this box, but I could also get email. I think this is going to go create that rule without. There we go. So I'll get email each time that alert fires. It'll also show up in the portal. So that allows me to get some more insight into how my account is performing. We'll cancel out of this. The other data that I see on the database account blade are the databases that are in my account, the usage of all of those databases, so how much storage am I consuming, the number of capacity units that I'm consuming. I can also configure the consistency level. So I talked through the different consistency levels, strong, session, bounded, and eventual. As I mentioned, by default, when we create a database account, session is the default value. Okay. So far, so good. Within the management experience, I can create databases. So I'll go ahead and create a new database. And here you can see in the database list, I called that my collection. I don't want to call it my collection. Let's delete it. Be careful. we may add some other CAPTCHA-like verification. This happens at an account level when you try to delete an account, where you have to enter in the account name. But I have fallen victim to deleting the wrong database by accident. So be careful when you click that delete database button. Okay, so we'll call this my database. Click OK. That'll get refreshed. So I can click into my database. And when I click into my database, now I see a scoped view of that monitoring data. So I can drill into those resources. I can look at the monitoring data. I can look at the collection data. And I can look at the usage data that is scoped to that particular resource. I can then create a collection. We'll just create my collection. We'll say OK. So now we have a collection. And similarly, when I click into the collection, I get the same scoped view of monitoring data for that particular collection. I get usage data as well. I haven't done anything with this collection yet or this database, so that data is empty. Okay. At the bottom of the account blade, as well as the database and collection blade, you'll see two tools. One is Document Explorer, and the other is Query Explorer. We'll get to Query Explorer in a little bit. But Document Explorer allows me to navigate into my database and into my collections and browse the data that's in that database. This week, we just released an update. Previously, you only had a read-only view of this data. Now you're actually able to edit and add new documents. So if we go here to create document, I can create a document. I can say my new document. And the Doc Explorer will verify that that is, in fact, valid JSON and won't let you store invalid JSON into the database. So that's now created. And, so that's a fairly simple JSON document. Let's grab something that's slightly more interesting. So the event people were kind enough to expose a JSON feed for all event data. So all session data, all room data. It turns out they had this already. They just had to turn it on. And we were able to get a JSON feed of this data, which turns out is fairly common. If you ask a web interface or a web property, hey, give me your data, they tend to give it to you in JSON these days. So a lot of web APIs expose this data as JSON. So here I can just grab this data. And this is just one example of one session. We'll go back into Doc Explorer and paste that in and save it. So now I can edit those documents within the Document Explorer. So this gives you some nice flexibility in terms of how you want to seed that data, how you want to view that data, how you want to edit that data. And that's all available through the Azure portal. Okay, so within the management portal, we've gone through creating an account, creating a database, creating a collection, looking at the monitoring data, setting up the alerts on those accounts, and we've done that all fairly quickly. I think, you know, less than 5 or 10 minutes or so, give or take. But if I want to go build an application, and I actually want to programmatically do some of the things that I just did through the portal, how would I do that? So here I have a really simple console app. I'll do these samples in .NET. Again, we have a Python SDK, a Node SDK, and a JavaScript SDK. But this is just a really simple console app that uses the .NET client to access that database account, to create a database, create a collection, effectively do the things programmatically that we just did through the management portal. So here you'll see at the top, let me highlight this, connection mode and connection protocol. By default, the connection mode is HTTP, and the connection protocol is HTTP. I just told you previously that the best performance is direct in TCP, so why on earth do we set a default that is gateway and HTTP? The reason that we did that is we found very early on as we onboarded customers that most people who use the document store start by using it outside of Azure, and typically on a development environment, and typically behind a firewall or behind a proxy. And so we were handling a lot of support calls around connection, and people couldn't establish connections, and largely it was because of authenticated proxies and things like that. So we changed the default to ease some of that onboarding and programmability, but when you are ready to deploy your code into Azure and when you're running it there, I strongly encourage you to use Direct and TCP as the connection policy. The next interesting line is this new document client. So the document client is what you'll use to interact with your database account. You pass in the URL for your account and the key. This is the primary key, similar to an Azure storage account. We have a primary key and a secondary key. And then optionally, you can pass in policy. This is the connection policy that will specify how to do connections. What you'll notice is when you initialize this client is the first sets of calls against DocumentDB will typically have higher latency than subsequent calls. And this is because, in particular, when you do direct connectivity, that logical to physical address mapping has to happen. So the client will do all of that work for you. It will do the work to renew and refresh that address cache. It will deal with addresses being invalid and going and fetching a new address. But all of that warm-up happens at startup time. So as you're warming up the client, it builds that cache. And so you'll see the few initial sets of calls that might have higher latency. And then after that, you'll see lower latency calls subsequently. Okay, so the next thing we're going to do is, this is just a helper function that does a get or create database async. The call here is I'm doing a create database async. I'm giving it a new database, and I'm specifying the ID. ID is guaranteed to be unique, so you can pass in the ID that you want for your database, and then we'll go ahead and create that database. Let's go back. Similarly, we're doing a get or create collection async. This is, again, just a helper function where we initially start by doing a link query to look for the collection. And if we don't find it, we go ahead and we create that collection. The thing you'll notice here is the introduction of DB link. As you use Document DB, you will start to discover things called self-links. Self-links are URIs to every resource. Every resource is uniquely addressable. And so the document client needs to disambiguate when it performs operations such as create document collection. It needs to disambiguate which database you want to create that collection again. You do that by providing a database link. And then here we just pass in a new document collection. And again, we specify the ID. ID also on collection is ID impotent, guaranteed to be unique. Okay. I'm going to skip over some of the cleanup. This is just a cleanup function. Let me step into this load data. So in the portal, I grabbed just raw JSON. I just grabbed some JSON. I threw it into the database. The database stored that JSON and was quite happy. Here what I'm doing in this program is I'm actually creating a session object. This is just a plain old C# object. It has all of the properties and attributes that exist in that JSON feed that the event team gave us for all the TechEd Europe sessions. And so I'm going to go and create session one, which is one session, is actually this session. And then I create session two, another new session, which is just a POCO plain old C# object with all of these attributes and properties, including some nested objects and nested properties. So you'll see the structure of that object is somewhat denormalized. And we'll talk about that in a minute and how to think about denormalizing your data. Then we create room objects. So here again, we're going to initialize these new room objects. We're going to assign the properties of those room objects. And then the last four lines of this function go and write those documents to the database. They provide the documents link. This is the documents link is the self-link resource link to documents within a specified collection. And then you pass in the objects that you want to serialize. These get serialized as JSON and stored in the database. You can do custom serialization and decorate your properties of your C# object if you want to do some custom serialization there. So this goes and writes both rooms and sessions to the same collection. The interesting thing to note here is that I'm not using different collections for the different object types. DocumentDB is quite good at storing heterogeneous documents. So you don't necessarily have to say, oh, well, I have documents of this type, I want to store them in one collection. I have documents of another type, I want to store them in another collection. You can commingle these documents, and because all of these documents are automatically indexed, you can then query for those documents and pull back those documents. The other thing to keep in mind as you want to query over these documents, or if you want to issue transactions or store procedures, triggers over these documents, think about your access patterns and where you're going to be operating over multiple documents and which documents you'll want transactional semantics against. Okay. So I'll just run this up to the breakpoint. This will go and create those documents. Hopefully this network lets me do direct connectivity. Yes. Okay. So there, we're just up to the breakpoint. So now we've effectively done programmatically what we did through the management portal by just cutting and pasting JSON into a collection that we created. Let me jump back to the deck. Okay, so some tips just on getting started, using DocumentDB, how to think about interacting with this. One is, as I mentioned, collections are not tables. Don't think of them as tables in a relational sense. Resist the urge to do that. The second is denormalize your data where appropriate. In this example, we chose not to denormalize rooms. It was somewhat arbitrary, but you may have a good reason for not doing that. You may not want to embed the room data in all of the sessions because maybe the room data is going to change periodically and you don't want the added costs of going and updating all of those documents when the room data changes. Or you don't want to have to go do that. So you may have left that normalized. Maybe we're going to store temperature in room and that's going to change periodically or current attendance and things like that. So that might be a good reason to leave that normalized. But document stores are very good at storing, retrieving aggregates. So as you think about how to structure your data, think about your UI patterns, how your applications are going to consume and read back that data, and that will inform how you want to structure that data, how much normalization, how much denormalization you want to do. People always want some kind of data modeling silver bullet or clear guidelines, and the answer is it really depends on the scenario. Okay, tuning in performance. We talked about connection policy, direct TCP where you can, that will give you the best performance. Reuse the document client. The document client is thread safe. All of that startup stuff that I talked about, the warm-up, you don't want to induce that overhead with every call. Occasionally, someone will send some code that says, hey, this doesn't perform well. This is really bad performance. We're not seeing good latency. And more often than not, it's because the connection policies is not set, and also because the document client's not being reused. On every call, someone's initializing a new document client. So avoid that pattern. And then consistency levels, think about where you can use relaxed consistency and get benefit from great read performance. So those are things to think about as you're just getting started in storing data with DocumentDB. Okay, on to query. So this magical auto index is often met with lots of skepticism. Are you really sure you want to do this? Is this really a good idea? So there are a few things that come into play. And as we think about the system and how the system's designed and optimized so that it can provide this automatic indexing. The first is, if you think of JSON documents as trees, turn them on their sides, and think of them as trees. Then union those trees. Then you get a logical union of all the properties within, if we're indexing a collection, within a collection. Once you do that, then certainly you apply some very interesting and efficient encoding schemes to store those efficiently and to navigate those efficiently. And there are some very novel techniques in terms of storage and data structures that would allow for this type of thing. And really, if you think of DocumentDB in the heart and the workhorse of DocumentDB, the indexing layer in index is kind of the core, one of the cores of DocumentDB in terms of where a lot of work is being done and a lot of time and energy has been spent in terms of making sure it's efficient. The second piece is consistent and automatic indexing. So building an index that can be kept up to date as it sustains a high volume of writes. And so DocumentDB will write to the index with every insert, will update the insert. So immediately after you insert a document, it's available for query. And you can query any of those properties. So this is done automatically and with full consistency. So you get the consistency level that you specified for your data. If you have strong consistency, you'll get strongly consistent index and data. The third piece is giving you a query interface and giving you a queryability over this database that kind of makes sense and is sort of natural or natural. And so as we developed the query interface, we looked at lots of different options, including building custom query languages that were very expressive, mapped closer to JSON and JavaScript, but were always met with, this is powerful once I spend the 20 hours I need to actually understand it, but weren't terribly approachable. So we ended up with a SQL-based query grammar. So if you look on the right-hand side of the slide, we see our good friend SelectFromWhere. You'll also see that expression of properties is done with dot notation. So dot notation is used to represent hierarchy within your JSON documents. There's also extension to the query grammar with keywords like in that take into account the fact that JSON contains arrays and lists, and you can iterate over those arrays. So you can do some really interesting things around iterating over arrays and then doing self-joins with the documents to effectively flatten arrays through a query grammar. And then we see the predicates and filter conditions. The last piece is, which I've called out here, is JavaScript extensibility. There's a function being referenced in that query called local tax. Local tax is application logic that's been stored in the database as a user-defined function and can be referenced as part of query evaluation. So you can effectively extend the query grammar to execute custom code. Okay, so let's do a demo. Let's show you some queries. I am going to go back to the Azure Management Portal. And I mentioned Query Explorer. Query Explorer is something that we released this week with our update for TechEd. Query Explorer will allow you to develop and troubleshoot queries from any browser against your database account. So if I pull up Query Explorer, I can select the database and the collection. As I mentioned, queries are scoped to collections. So here I have a collection called Session Data. Session Data has been preloaded with all of the TechEd Europe session data. So if I just do a select star, a good old select star from, I'm aliasing that collection as S, or sessions, then it will retrieve all the records, all the documents within those collections. Those documents are returned in the results pane, and so here I have a paginated view. I'll get 100 documents at a time, and then I can page through those results. The SDKs will do that pagination for you, some of that pagination for you, and so you can specify page size if you want a larger page size than 100, you can specify that as well. Okay, so let's do a more interesting query. Let's just get the rooms. So we want to apply a filter condition and just get the room documents that we inserted in the previous demo. So here are those hall room documents. You can see the IDs for those documents. Again, IDs are unique and supplied by you. So these are guaranteed to be unique. But let's say that I want to get back some of the session data, but it's not, let me just do this. It's not terribly efficient to bring back all of that session data. My app may not need all of that session data, so I can do projections on top of the document. So I reference the properties that I want to return, and then DocDB will just give me those projections from those documents. So here I just want session ID, and I want title, and that's returned in the results pane. Now let's do a filter condition. So if I were looking for all of these sessions, but I want them where we're in the data platform and BI track, so the track that we're in, and I want to look for the external track, so this is specifying the data platform and BI track, and I want to look for these 300 level talks. So give me all of the 300 level talks here at TechEd Europe in the database and BI track. So there you have all the session IDs and the titles for all of those talks. But I'm a little curious. I want to find my session, this DocDB session. So one of the things that I did when I wrote that console app is I took the abstract and I tokenized the words. So what this allowed me to do is word lookup. So that abstract was tokenized into an array of words. I can then use the in keyword to iterate over that array and extract the documents where the keyword matches document DB. So here I'll pull session ID, title, and words, which are those keywords from those documents. So you'll see there's four sessions that have document DB in the abstract. The first is the intro to NoSQL. This was David's session yesterday. Data platform evolution, which was Aaron Kelly's keynote. And then there's a lab session, which is building an ASP.NET application using Azure Document DB. And then the session that we're in currently. So let's get the start time for that session. So we want to project s.starttimeEU. So what local start time do we have for these sessions? So we'll run that query, and we'll get the start time projection, and we'll look at that. And of course, everyone can read ticks and epoch time. That makes sense. No. But often the question comes up, you know, how do I store dates? JSON does not have a date type. So often we get the question, how do I store dates in DocumentDB? How do I express them within the store? How do I serialize them? And typically what we encourage people to do is use ticks or epoch time. But then you get into these situations here where I have a tick count, but it doesn't really make sense. So let's use some of the JavaScript integration to make some sense out of that and extend the query evaluation. So I'm going to close these results, and I'm just going to update this query. And now I'm referencing getDateString. This is a user-defined function stored in the database that will operate over that s.startTimeEU and project that as date. So we'll go ahead and run that. And then what that's done is extracted the date from that tick count. And if you go look at, let's pull up that JavaScript function. It's a very simple JavaScript function. It's just taking that date long and then converting it to JSON and splitting it to take the date out. Very simple, but a very interesting way to extend that query evaluation. We can also start to customize some and materialize JSON as part of query evaluation. So I may want to decide, I may say, well, I don't really like how that property structure. I don't like how StartTimeEU and my app doesn't really deal with that well. My app is expecting a set of epoch times, and it deals with epoch times that way. So what I can do is I can actually start to materialize JSON as part of the projection. So here I have start. So I'm creating a new property that is start. I'm putting in the epoch time, and I'm nesting that underneath a new property. So if we run that and see the results of that query, here you see epoch times, and nested underneath that property are the start times. So you can start to do some really interesting things in terms of how you shape the result set as it comes out of the query pipeline. You can customize the JSON projections as they come out. You can also evaluate and run JavaScript functions as part of the query pipeline. So the last thing I want to show is a range lookup. The reason for storing epoch times is so that we can do range-based queries on the date and time. This allows me to do a range-based query. So you'll just have to take my word for it that these are the right epoch times for this current session. But what I want to see are, what are the sessions that currently overlap with this session? Same or later start time, same or earlier end time. And this is doing a range-based query on start time and end time. So if I run that query, I can see these are all the sessions that are going on right now. So if you want to run out of the room and catch, there you go, go catch this end of some other session. These are the sessions that are overlapping with this time. Now, one of the things I talked about is being tunable as a system. Consistency levels are tunable, but indexing policy is also tunable. So by default, we will index all properties within a document. But we know, and we've already had people come and say, yeah, but I have these indexing cases, I have these indexing properties that I'm not interested in, or I have a certain precision that's expected. So for this collection to support a range-based query, there's a custom indexing policy on that collection. The indexing policy is created at collection time. So by default, the indexing policy is what I've highlighted. Automatic indexing is set to true, indexing mode is set to consistent, and by default, a hash index is created for every path in the document. You can retrieve this indexing policy from any collection, and again, you can supply indexing policy upon collection creation time. For this particular collection, you'll see that I have range-based indexes on all of these times. And this allows me to do efficient range-based queries on those numbers. So as you think about the different query patterns, it's important to know where you're going to do range-based queries and where you may want to create these range-based indexes. Now, a common request is, hey, I want to be able to update these things as my data changes and maybe I want to make trade-offs on query performance. I want to update this indexing policy. We are planning and working on to do dynamic indexing policy so that you can update these after creation time. It's currently not available with the preview. The other thing to note is with indexing policy, you can specify exclusion paths. So if you have portions of your document that you know you will never query, you can specify those as exclusion. You save the storage, and you also save on the write time of actually processing those properties as part of the index. So we do think that, you know, for the broad majority of application scenarios, the default automatic indexing works for a lot of people, but also understanding that people will want to get in there and modify the policy and modify how the indexing is working over their data. So that too is supported. Okay. Back to Slideware. Okay, so just tips and tricks on queries and indexing. Again, consider your query needs. If you need to do these range-based queries, if it makes sense to exclude some data from your index, these policies are immutable. So at collection creation time, you need to specify these. We're working to make that better. Understand your query cost limits and avoid scans. So I'll talk a little about so I'll talk about it now. Resource units. Resource units are how we measure performance request units are how we measure performance and throughput of the system. Every call, every query returns a request charge, which says how much did it cost the system to process this particular request. So as you're running your queries, understand the costs associated with those queries. Let me just quickly pull up the management portal. Within the management portal, if you see the query explorer, you'll see this at the bottom, request charge. How many RUs? So think of RUs as a normalized request unit. And so this is a proxy for how much CPU, memory, and I/O did it actually take us to serve this particular request. As you purchase DocumentDB capacity units, you purchase these RUs. RUs are a per second rate, so you have an allotment per second. If you go above that allotment, you will start to get throttled. So that alert that I created is an interesting alert to keep configured on your account. Okay, back to Slideware. Then the other thing is, currently we do not support aggregates as part of the query grammar. Common request, something we're absolutely looking at. So in light of this, if you need aggregates, you have a couple options. You can pre-aggregate, use in the current document, have an aggregate value that is calculated, or a separate document that has aggregate values. Or you can aggregate client-side. So bring the data down or bring the data down that's interesting to you and do that aggregation. That typically would induce a scan. So back to the try to avoid those scans because those are costly. Okay. Last piece. I know we're running out of time. JavaScript transactions. So JavaScript integration in the database allows you to process multiple documents by expressing JavaScript functions as stored procedures and triggers. JavaScript execution is all sandboxed and isolated. It is language integrated. What do we mean by language integrated? Language integrated means if I throw an exception in JavaScript, it'll actually roll back the transaction. So there's an implicit transaction that wraps every stored procedure and every trigger. Triggers can be executed as pre or post condition triggers. So you have that flexibility. Again, these are registered at the collection level. You register stored procedures and triggers. You have ACID guarantees and transactional semantics associated with those triggers and those stored procedures. And let's show you one of those stored procedures. So I'll go ahead and do that. Okay, so back to Visual Studio. Here is a stored procedure, which is JavaScript, that I've registered on the collection. This stored procedure takes two session IDs and then does a room swap for those session IDs. So in the interest of time, I won't necessarily walk you through all of this code. But effectively, what we're doing is we're finding the rooms associated with each session, and then we do a swap of those rooms within the session documents. The interesting pieces to note, you'll see this exception being thrown. So in itself, just being able to transactionally update those sessions with that room data is interesting. No reader is ever going to get a view of a partially committed transaction or a room that's been swapped before the other one's been swapped back. So that's useful. The other thing I can do is apply conditions to that swap. In this particular case, I'm actually looking at the room size or room.capacity and the session attendee count. Session attendee count's changing over time. And when I go to do that swap on each room, I want to make sure that the capacity is not exceeded by the attendee count. If that happens, I throw. I say, I can't allocate this session. This room is full. Roll back this transaction. So the first swap had already happened. And then once that exception is thrown, because the second swap or second room can't be allocated, then the first update is rolled back. And then you can return a custom response from that throw. So that comes all the way back to the client, and the client can look at that exception. So if we go back to the program that we're running, I'm going to stop it for a minute. I won't go through the code that actually creates a stored procedure, but very similar to some of the code that was written on creating a database and creating a collection. And here what we do is we do a room swap that should succeed. And then there's an update where this breakpoint is set, where we're setting the property attendee count to 250. And then with that second update, then we expect that transaction to fail and get rolled back. So if I run this, swap rooms, okay. Bring this up. So here we did a room swap. That swap successfully happened. Everyone's happy. They're in new rooms. And then we then continue running this, and we update the attendee count. And you can see that exception got thrown. And there's the exception message in there, cannot allocate session. And that's because the attendee count is now exceeding the capacity of that room, and that is rolled back. All right. Okay, JavaScript transactions, tips and tricks. Again, understand transaction costs. Request charge will come back on transactions as well. Requests with stored procedures and triggers. Look at how much charge you induce with a data volume that you would expect. Commonly what we see is someone will create a stored procedure or a trigger, and then that thing runs, and then data volume grows, and data volume grows, and data volume grows, and then all of a sudden it gets very slow and very expensive to run that stored procedure or trigger. So as you're writing your stored procedures and trigger, understand what the behavior is at your expected data volumes, and keep that in mind. The other thing to keep in mind is the 5-second rule. I mentioned that we do some things to guard against bad stored procedures and transactions. The 5-second rule is one of those things. We will time out a stored procedure after 5 seconds. You don't get more than 5 seconds to do some work. If you need more than 5 seconds to do longer running stored procedures, there's a continuation model, but you have to batch your updates. This is to both protect you in terms of runaway consumption of resources, but also to protect the service. Over time, we'll evaluate that 5 seconds and whether we should adjust that or not. But we've set it at a very conservative level to kind of suss out some of the patterns there. I talked about testing with expected data volumes. And then strategy for versioning and code management. I didn't show the creation of that stored procedure. But what I've done through my application is I've treated that stored procedure as a code asset of the application. So when the application comes online, it looks for a stored procedure. It will create it, and it will update it if it finds it. So it always makes sure that it has a known version of the stored procedure created. There are other strategies for managing server-side code and code registered with the database, but definitely think through this and how you want to do that for your application. Okay, so recap. Just some of the things that we talked through. Collections, it is absolutely okay to store heterogeneous documents in a single collection. It's fine. The system is designed to handle this case and handles it quite well. I didn't use the link provider in the C# client, but there is a link provider. You can query the system through a link provider, or you can query the system using that SQL grammar. Queries, the portal has a great experience for you to develop, and we'll be continuing to invest on that and doing query analysis, things that might look a little like query plan optimization type stuff, but expect that to get better over time in terms of the tooling that's supported in the portal experience. Index policies to tune your queries, and then just transaction processing. Think through the scenarios, think through the data volume, just back to some of those tips and tricks on transactions. Some topics that we didn't spend a ton of time on that are opportunities to explore further. There's a consistency, data consistency paper on the Azure website that will give you more background on data consistency and how you should think about making trade-offs on performance and data consistency. The second thing is extending queries and writing user-defined functions. How do you do that? How to think about doing that? There's another great article on Azure.com on how to do that. And then scaling and performance, how to manage these CUs, how to think about distributing your data within your database account. There's another good article there. So the call to action, here's everything you need to get started. The first link will take you to the sign-up page and take you to the portal and allow you to create one of those database accounts. You can configure it through the portal, download SDKs, build samples. There are some useful links for you there. And then feedback. We want your feedback. We need your feedback. We love your feedback. Please give it to it as frequently and as unvarnished as you want. So there's a forum for providing feedback. There's a feedback.azure.com, which allows you to post and vote up ideas. So if you say, hey, you guys should do this and it would be great, then you can either vote up existing ideas or add new ideas. We use this regularly as we prioritize how we're going to invest in the service. It's a great thing that we kind of use in the team and we're like, hey, this is the number one or this is the number two thing, and we really need to spend time on it. So use that as much as you can. On Twitter, we're at DocumentDB. When all else fails, feel free to email me or follow me on Twitter. And that's it. Let's see. I'll get you to the session eval. Session eval, there you go. All right, thank you.